Good afternoon. Friday, WTIC. We're joined by Michael Harrison from Talkers Magazine during the first hour. How are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you, Todd?
Awesome. Excited. Pumped.
It's great to be. Huh?
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, when you're out of your normal routine, do you have this issue when you travel that you can't wait to get back home just so you can be in your normal patterns and not have everything disrupted?
I think we're all like that. I think that's a human trait. I think that we crave normalcy, regularity, you know, what we're familiar with, our routines, our habits. Yeah, definitely.
So I'm still celebrating New Hampshire ending on Tuesday and coming back home and feeling the groove of normal day-to-day life.
How long were you away?
4 days.
You were there for 4 days?
Mm.
Oh, my, 4 days in New Hampshire?
Yes.
Wow, that's a long time. Were there a lot of things going on? Or did you find yourself with large lulls? Like you and Mike Ulko have to go bowling or things like that?
No, so. We didn't even think of that, or we probably would have just ignored the elections. But but there were, you know, the candidates, one of them's on the seacoast, one of them's up in the lakes region, one of them's over on the Connecticut River, and you're trying to figure out, you know.
Can I be so egotistical and bold as to say the reason that New Hampshire wasn't as exciting for broadcasters this time around was because I wasn't there?
That's as good a reason as any.
No, we used to organize the radio rows, and yes. we'd have 30, 40, 50 people in a very well-organized place, and we would insist that the candidates... I mean, the real big ones, not necessarily some of the, you know, the offbeat ones that run in New Hampshire by buying their way onto the ballot. But, you know, the real major candidates would come to this place, and for a full 2 days, there was action, constant action. I have photos in my, you know, my scrapbook, so to speak, although mm-hmm. now they're all digitized, of all kinds of, not, you know, major political figures and Hollywood stars. I mean, big people would come through there, and great broadcasters. And I understand this year there wasn't such a well-organized central point, so it got a little splashed out everywhere. And then what are you going to do, run around a state? You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, there was not that kind of organization. You not being there with Talkers Magazine, organizing the radio row and having all the radio stations in one place, and the fact that no other organizer stepped in to do it until at the last minute, the hotel just did it themselves to create a space, but they didn't do the organizing. So there was nobody really corralling the candidates and getting them to come through, and that was a disappointment that... Because normally at Radio Rose, the ones you ran, you would, as a host, you would just sit there, and every few minutes there'd be somebody running up. You know, do you want the governor? Do you want the senator? And you wouldn't have to lift a finger.
It was astonishing. We took those days for granted. Now, the only reason we didn't do it this year was because we figured, hey, let someone else do it. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, it's a pain.
It wasn't my most fun thing to organize. But I was shocked when I found out, because people are calling me, where's the Radio Row this year? Where's the Radio Row? I mean, we're talking major broadcasters were calling me. And I said, I don't know. I chose to sit this one out, and nobody really picked it up. So the hotel was probably getting calls. Are you doing a Radio Row again? And they probably decided, let's give them a place to put them. You know, it's better for them to have all that action. They sell a lot of booze at the bar, if not rooms. I think all the rooms are sold out in Manchester.
Yeah, it's pretty packed. I looked a few weeks before. I looked on Airbnb, and they had, you know, they were listing towns in Massachusetts as the available Airbnbs if you wanted to be in Manchester, New Hampshire, which is, you know, at least an hour away from where you would want to be.
My first experience in New Hampshire was as a talk show host with WTIC. It was before Talkers did the Radio Rose back in the 92 election. And there was a fellow named Tom Ray. Tom Ray was the chief engineer of WTIC. He's probably the best engineer that radio has ever seen, and TIC was blessed to have him. And he and I went up to Manchester, and he had a device that made us the envy of the broadcasters. And back in those days, it was basically loosely around a hotel, but there was no radio row. And he had a device. It was called a mobile telephone. Mm-hmm. It was the size of a large suitcase. It weighed about 100 pounds, and we schlepped it to a central location, and everybody was stunned that we were able to broadcast on a telephone. It was just a telephone, but that we had telephone access wherever we went. This was 1992, and a mobile phone was considered to be outrageously high tech. We were the envy of the entire place. And we had every candidate. It was astonishing.
You mean every candidate because they wanted to come make a phone call on a suitcase phone?
Because we weren't just recording, we were live.
That's amazing. You were their Maxwell Smart.
Yeah, I was on the air for hours, and we were just having a ball. And that was the year that there were a ton of Democrats running around. There was Clinton, there was Tsongas, there was Harkin, there was, all kinds of interesting people. Oh, Jerry Brown. They called them the Seven Dwarves because the main Democrat power candidates, typified by Mario Cuomo, had decided not to run in 92 because George H.W. Bush was considered unbeatable as the incumbent.
Yeah.
So they had a bunch of secondary people, crazy old Jerry Brown, this young loudmouth from Arkansas, Bill Clinton, a few others that no one really heard of. And, the rest is history. It began the Clinton dynasty. So I always felt the person who wins becomes the big person. You never know until the votes are cast and the election is done and the buildup comes and there's conventions and the crowds get bigger and bigger and bigger and the banners, and all of a sudden you've got a new political giant on your hands.
Well, that's one of the things I find exciting about getting behind the curtain up in New Hampshire, is that you get to realize the smallness that there is to it, that it's really that nobody owns this stuff most of the time. And even a Joe Biden, who spent 8 years as vice president hanging around with Barack Obama and being in those circles, being in the circles of power after his 470 years in the U.S. Senate. And even then, he's just a cardboard figure running around hoping to catch some kind of wave that's going to carry him somewhere. But the power is not inside of him. The power is in this process and the votes that we cast.
The human element really is on display, is what you're saying, the reality of it. We tend to think of it as larger than life, already preordained.
Yes, institutionalized somehow.
Yes, yes. And it is exactly that way. And that's one of the things that I noticed when I first started to cover things of that nature. How'd Mike Olko do? Mike, did you enjoy being there?
Oh, he loved it because
he got to
spend
time.
A lot of time with me.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that...
That was a side effect.
That was a side benefit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Was there anything about it that surprised you?
How old Joe Biden looked in person. That was a little bit shocking.
the sad thing about Biden, I guess we can talk about him because he obviously...
He's not here.
He's not... Oh, that's terrible. I feel guilty now. The thing about Joe Biden that makes the fact that everybody complains about how old he looks, and that makes me a little queasy, because I'm against ageism and that type of discrimination, but I'm just talking the facts. People are saying he's old, he's sleepy, he's maybe a little bit daft, is that he's gone to so much trouble over the years to look good. He's had hair weaving, he's clearly had facelifts. I don't think that his face looks the same as it used to. You know, when people have had one too many plastic surgeries.
Yes.
On their.
But he doesn't have the Michael Jackson effect or anything.
No. But he doesn't look like he would have looked had he not had all that work.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. I mean, for what it's worth.
But even though he doesn't look bad. And even though you think of it as being ageism, the fact is, as people get older, it's likely that they get in a position where they're not operating as with as much facility in whatever way and whatever level as they were before. So it's appropriate to look and to study and to find out what's there. And when Joe Biden can't really keep pace with the free flow of ideas in a debate, that's legitimate for people to think about. That's not being ageist, is it?
No. No, it's ageist when you exaggerate it. It's ageist when you say, he's senile if he's, you know, fumbles over a word or doesn't remember something and immediately attribute it to his age. The truth is, Biden used to trip over his tongue when he was young.
In a different way, though. He would say things that were racist or moronic, but it seems to me now he just has trouble constructing thoughts and monitoring what he's saying.
And I think one of the problems with Biden, and this is a very interesting phenomenon, is I don't think he has a core set of principles. I don't think he has a platform. And I think that especially here in the 21st century, you've got to have talking points. You have to stand for something other than the fact that you have experience. And he doesn't seem to have done the kind of homework it takes to be a viable candidate.
But don't you think he's being told, like they have these brainstorming sessions with his consultants and they say, Joe, you're perfectly positioned. Just keep putting on your makeup. Make sure your hair is perfectly coiffed because we just don't want anything to stick to you that could harm your chances. Your chances are structural. Don't speak and screw it up.
That might be going on, but they're not doing him any favors, or they're giving him his best shot that he can't come up with anything to stand for because he is so politically or ideologically vacuous. He's been to the left. He's been to the right. He's been through this administration. He's been for that. He's run for president 3 or 4 times. He's famous for being famous. And let's face it, no matter how he tries to spin it, he was not a major player in the Obama administration. He claims he was, but he wasn't. Ooh,
so I like it. You just developed a slogan for him. Joe Biden, not a major player.
He's not
it's
a major player.
Kind of catchy.
Of course, if he were really smart, he'd use that to his advantage. Say, no, I didn't do a damn thing during the Obama administration. He never took my advice.
It's not my fault.
I told him not to do that stupid Obamacare. I told him it would never work.
Michael Harrison is here. It's Friday. Stay with us on WTIC. So every week, on WTIC Fridays, this hour, Michael Harrison is here. And in addition to being the publisher of Talkers Magazine, I'm learning that Michael is also a rapper, which is kind of exciting. Tell us about your career in rap.
I'm a rap star. Yeah, I have a show called The Michael Harrison Rap, only it's spelled W-R-A-P, meaning it's a wrap-up of the week's event, and I really don't rap. Although, when I first started in radio, we used the word rap. Before there was this genre of rap music, and we used to call rap was a word for talking. You know, hey, man, let's sit down and rap a little bit.
Yes.
And it was short for rapport.
Mm-hmm. And you would do that while you were smoking a bone or something.
Or trying to create the impression you were smoking a bone.
Yes.
That was, we didn't call them bones in those days.
Okay, but what's this Michael Harrison rap? Tell people about it.
Well, the Michael Harrison rap is basically a weekly radio show that exists out there in the far reaches of
you
radio.
You produce it, and it's syndicated, right?
Oh, yeah, we produce it, and you're the guest this week.
Which is cool.
Yeah, you're talking all about your experiences in New Hampshire. And you and I kick off the show. It's got a panel of people on it, and you're the main guy.
I didn't mess it up, did I?
You did fantastic.
Oh,
you were sensational. And if anybody wants to hear it, they can hear it at MHRap. That's a W, MHRap.com, and it stars Todd Feinberg.
Oh, good. I'll go there to listen. Yeah. MHRap with a W.
With a W, right.
.com.
Yeah. But I am what's I'm a rap star. That's like being a rapper of presents at Christmas, you know?
My sense was that in talk radio that syndication has become harder. There was a time where there was tons of syndication and syndicated programs, but now it seems like there's Rush and there's Sean, and there's not a lot of room for anything else.
That's a complicated question, and basically in radio, maybe there are more syndicated shows now than ever before because there are fewer local hosts than ever before. However, we do have some very established programs. You know, the talk radio phenomenon that we used to call it of the 80s and the 90s has turned into talk radio being the biggest and most established radio format of them all. Mm-hmm. And the basic hub of a wheel of media that goes beyond radio. Cable news talk television, Fox, CNN, MSNBC, and so many of the others that are of that ilk are really talk radio on television with a lot of graphics and pictures. But they're really basically the format of the talk show, a host with an opinion, having guests and commenting on the issues of the day in a slightly partisan way, targeted at a certain audience, and they do a dance of affirmation.
But, you know, there's something exciting about what you just described. And people, I think the average person wouldn't hear or feel or sense the difference. But I was listening to a podcast with a couple of reporters fleshing out a story. And they were so reporterly. They were old timers and reluctantly giving their opinion. I thought, this is so dull. They're not, you know, hitting each other over the head with opinion. And the opinion kind of drives it all and makes it fun. Give a short response, but in 20 seconds we're going to an EAS test, Michael.
Okay, well, short response is opinion is great when it's backed up by somebody doing facts, somebody who at least presents the table, sets the table.
First,
exactly.
Okay. So, yeah, we're going to break. Michael Harrison is here for the hour, and we'll talk more in just a minute. We've got to do this quick test. Stay with us on WTIC. Yeah, it's WTIC. We're talking with Michael, and there is a ton of political news going on. We haven't really – I mean, we talked about being in New Hampshire, but that primary happened, and it kicked a lot of new momentum and new direction into the presidential race for the Democrats. What's your sense of things right now, Michael?
Well, certainly we're in the post-impeachment era, where we're in the tail end of that. That is gone. We're in the I am very, very confident being president and having unlimited power era of Donald Trump's first term in office. We are definitely off to the races. We're going to be having all these primaries coming up, and who knows, maybe the Democrats won't get it together and we'll have a brokered convention, and that'll be something that will be really good television and good radio. It'll be a very exciting thing.
A brokered convention would be so dramatic. I don't even think people know what that would mean, but that would mean that at the convention it would be like the old days.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where the smoke-filled rooms without the smoke would be the place where arms got twisted and things got worked out.
Yeah, well, some people feel the smoke-filled room actually created a situation where the candidate represented the ideology of the party more than the current primary situation does. It's as if the leaders of the parties today have to resort to fraud and to crime in order to
have some control over their own process.
Over their own process and their own party's ideology.
But whose process is it? Are they right to think it's theirs, or does it belong to the people?
I don't know. I'm not sure. A political party is basically a private organization, if you think about it. It's nonprofit, but it's private. I mean, if you and I started a party tomorrow based upon our principles, we're not happy with the Democrats or Republicans, how would you feel if suddenly other people came along and told us who's going to be the candidate of our party?
It would be very weird. It would take a lot of adjustment, but there would be a key point. I think there was for Democrats and Republicans where they decided that they would turn it over to voters, because then when they would have more buy-in, then they would know that when the time came everybody or a lot of people would be behind the candidate. Michael Harrison is here. It's Friday. Stay with us on WTIC. Yep, Michael Harrison is here from Talkers Magazine. You can learn more about him at Talkers.com. Talkers is the trade Bible of the talk radio industry. It's nice that there is such a thing. And, a couple days ago, Michael, we were talking about the presidential election and discussing Pete Buttigieg and whether his gayness is a factor, because I've always felt that the focus on people's differences is driven in large part by the media. They look for easy stories that touch nerves. And, you know, they made a big thing about Jack Kennedy being Catholic and Barack Obama being black, and voters didn't care about that. And I have a feeling the same would be true with Pete Buttigieg. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think for the most part, you're correct. Obviously, there were people who did not like Kennedy's Catholicism or Barack Obama's race, and I'm sure there are people that would not like Buttigieg's gender orientation or whatever it is, whatever that's called in terms of categories. But I think that we're living in an era now where we're beyond that being the primary concern. I mean, you stop and think about how enlightened we are in terms of accepting people of different types and judging them on other biases. We judge them on the bias of whether they're a socialist or a capitalist. We judge them on the bias of whether they're a Democrat or a Republican. We judge them on the bias of whether they're rich or they're poor. I mean, there's all, where they come from. But,
well, you've missed the big one. Who's tallest?
Oh, my gosh, that was set up for. I set myself up and I didn't go for it. Isn't that funny? What, 7 out of 10 of the last, presidential elections went to the tallest person? And Trump is now calling poor little Mike Bloomberg Little Michael or whatever. Mario and Little Michael. Yeah.
I run these scenarios on who would be an effective opponent for the Democrats against Donald Trump. And Michael Bloomberg is so diminutive that it's hard to imagine him going toe-to-toe, as it were, with Trump.
Well, let me point something out to you that may change your opinion on the specificity of height having an impact. I think that Vladimir Putin is the same height as Michael Bloomberg.
Well, he doesn't have to run against anyone. Those are fixed elections.
No, what I'm saying is that when Trump and Vladimir Putin get together, sometimes you get the impression that Putin is the bigger man.
Oh, I don't know. I haven't noticed that.
Russia.
I just figured they put a hole in the floor for Trump to stand in so that he.
I never realized that, Bloomberg is a small man. I judge people by the size of their wallet.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you're not superficial at all.
No, but I think it's I just think what you're talking about is just how silly, how juvenile, and how thoroughly entertaining politics has become. And if Bloomberg gets the nomination, I mean, we've had a taste of the tweet war already. The insults that are going back and forth between Bloomberg and Trump are fascinating. They are insulting each other personally, and in terms of their appearance, in terms of their backgrounds, in terms of every possible flaw that they can find in the other guy, they're hurling it already via tweet.
I haven't followed this. Any are you keeping tabs on who's getting the best of this?
I think obviously Bloomberg is getting the best of it because he's not president. He's got this. I don't know. There's something about Bloomberg that he's so powerful. He is so rich and so successful in terms of his political career. He's not lost, anything.
Yep.
He seems to be able to hold his own with Trump. And just the very fact that anybody can hold their own with Trump makes them seem to win.
Well, that's what I don't know if he would actually be able to do on the stage with him. There's this psychological confrontational dynamic that I don't feel that any of them could handle except for maybe Buttigieg.
Well, that'll be interesting. Buttigieg is a whole different animal, but Trump is completely confident. They talked about back during the clown car era of the 2016 election when he was on the stage with 17 professional politicians that he would not be able to keep up in terms of the issues and wouldn't be able to hold his own. And he totally, you know, wiped the floor with them. So now Trump is a master of all things that have to do with public relations, politics,
and
media.
power. He's at a peak now of his confidence about himself as president and having shaped it more the way he wants it shaped. That is, it's his organism, this government. It doesn't belong to those protocols, those democratic protocols that people
That should trouble you as a, you know, as an ardent Trump supporter. You and I talked about this. I've talked about this for years now in the Trump era, that just the way he covets power and the way he seems to accumulate power is scary, because power is frightening, whether it's held by a left or a right or a party or an individual, whatever, a benign king. Power is dangerous. And the one of the things that keeps the United States of America, you know, positive and free and democratic and independent, all the things we talk about, is the fact that we are very, very suspect of anything that gets too much power. So this is not an attack on Trump. It's an attack on any president that has the facility to have power the way he does. The other thing about Trump that should concern us, and it's starting to become evident, I mean, maybe it's been evident from the beginning, he considers anybody that legitimately challenges him to suddenly be worthy of being insulted and criticized on a level that is far beyond, you know, what's right. And they say, well, he's a counterpuncher. If you punch him, he'll punch you back hard. Like, that's a good thing. Well, counterpunching is, you know, going after a mosquito with a hammer if the mosquito happened to, you know, land on you. It's not symmetrical. He, you know, anybody that goes against Trump is immediately subject to being ridiculed, insulted, and called out for being dishonest, being a crook, being evil, that it's immoral in his mind for anybody to challenge him on any level. That's scary to me.
Well, all of this is different. There's no doubt. It doesn't concern me, because what is concerns me. What happens when you have each president doing a president imitation, wearing the right suit, speaking the right words, reading from the right teleprompter, making sure the pose is identical to the previous president's, the power is still rushing through and having effects, but it's doing it invisibly, and it's more behind the scenes, controlled by power structure manipulators. So I kind of like this as an adjustment period. I can't claim I know what's going to happen to it, but I do know that what outraged, I think, voters to the point where we felt that Bernie Sanders, outrageous on the left, and Donald Trump, outrageous on the right, were the best alternatives, is because they sensed a stench coming from business as usual.
And now Bernie is getting the same kind of, you know, Bernie derangement syndrome from a lot of people, the same way Trump did for that very thing. Just because you are opposed to a stodgy or a impotent status quo doesn't necessarily mean that you are the right medicine for the disease. And this is where the book of Trump has yet to be written. Whether or not whatever period of adjustment Trump has facilitated, as you say, whether or not in the end we will be better off for it, or it will lead to some type of a dictator or king 20, 30 years from now based upon the precedent that this president has set.
Well, we have the privilege as voters still to point in a new direction if we choose. And what I think is interesting is, as we get more polarized, which everybody laments, That lament is largely led by media talking heads, the same ones who seem to get everything else wrong. And I'm wondering if maybe this hyper-volatized dynamic will lead to some clarity in terms of choices, and that the people as voters will decide they want one version of reality versus the other, one interpretation, one narrative over the other, and then make a decision for the country and move it back towards being more traditionally democratic after it feels comfortable that the people are back in control.
Well, if in fact people can live with being loyal opposition, you make a good point, and it's very possible that it'll happen. But what troubles me is that it just could send the pendulum swinging in the other direction. If
towards meltdown, you mean?
Toward now the Republicans doing to a Democrat president what the Democrats have done to this Republican president. That as soon as Bernie becomes president, or Bloomberg, or whomever,
yeah.
They begin the impeachment thing. They begin the witch hunt. They begin.
That goes without saying that they will. You know, they're basically all baseball players prepared to take the steroids if that's what's necessary to compete on the long ball. So yeah, they will. But what I'm saying is, in the larger sense, the reason we have all this turmoil is because we're split 50-50 and the people haven't decided where they want us to go. And when the people choose a direction between those poles, then it will get easier. That's my hypothesis.
Well, I think that's sweet and very good. And I hope you're right. I just fear that the people may not choose the other pole very readily, that they'll resent the other side. That
you mean they'll remain 50-50 and keep swinging back and forth?
Yeah. That I don't know how deep this goes, and I don't know what it would take for somebody to be a healer in an environment where the media actually stokes the flames of discord for the sake of keeping the show interesting and making money. And
that's a good point about the media. Structurally, that's what the media is inclined to do, and becomes more so every year as they become more strapped financially and more lustful for an easy solution to their problems.
Darn right. That's what's happening, and that's a problem. That's very dangerous, because the media is important. Free speech is important. The freedom of the press is important, and the press is important. It's so important. I think Thomas Jefferson said, as bad as the press is, he'd rather have a free press than have a government without the press. You have a government and you don't have the fake news, you're a lot worse off than you are even with fake news.
Yeah, we need to know what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Michael Harrison, good conversation. Let's take a little break. We'll continue it on WTIC. WTIC. So we're talking to Michael Harrison, Talkers Magazine. He's our Friday regular. Thank you for doing that. I think we've been doing this every week for 2.5 years. Is that right?
I think so. I think we're about 3 years into this somehow. Yeah.
Have you ever done anything for the? I mean, this is longer than your marriage is, right?
This is longer than I've done anything in my life. Yeah, I've never been able to keep a job or even be welcome as a guest for more than maybe 2 weeks. So this is a big deal. How am I doing? I mean, do you want to get rid of me? Am I annoying?
No, I don't think so. I don't get complaints about you. I get comments of appreciation. I think everything's good. We have a good time. But there's, you know, when I think about long-term projects like this, relationships like this, it's always a difficult thing to keep things going for a long time. And there's a benefit. It's easy sometimes to turn away and say, oh, that's frustrating, forget about it. But when you push through the frustration, then you have a chance to make a richer thing happen. And I feel like we're at a time, we certainly can think of it with marriage, that marriage has become more disposable in our society. And that means that the people who are staying together longer become less in numbers. At least it seems that way.
Yeah.
But there's something
beautiful. You're saying.
Yeah, go ahead.
If I can jump in, what you're saying, I gather, is that relationships, partnerships, teamsmanships, if you will, or teams' womanships are hard to do. That is just simply a system by which you have to work. If you're in a marriage, if you're in a business together, or in this case, you and I, for 1 hour a week, we do a radio team thing. It's your show, and I am the guest, but we play it like we're a two-man show for 1 hour a week, and we've done it for years. These are hard to do. Why did the Beatles break up? Why did Martin and Lewis, they were the hottest comedy team in the world, and they had to break up. They could no longer live with each other. And folks listening to this, I'm not kidding around, Todd and I have had a couple of conversations over the years, like, okay, where are we at with this thing? And we work through little snags here and there. And I the fact is we do it because we like to do it. This is not like a contracted gig. So it is amazing that we've gone for years doing this, isn't it?
Well, I don't know about amazing, but delightful. And I think something to be proud of because of the things that you just itemized. And it does bring to mind music, which we discuss a lot. And bands that are big, you think about how much money they're making working with each other. And you can't understand how they can walk away from it because it's so unlikely to have big success. They just let their egos and their delicacy as people get in the way of some great thing that they're achieving.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I like about you as a person is that you're pretty tough when it comes to that. You're not brittle, and you're not you don't take offense at criticism or disagreement that a lot of people do. And that's something I could share with the listeners, knowing you all these years. It's one of many things about you, Todd, that I admire and I enjoy working with you, is that I could say to you, hey, I didn't like that, or hey, why are we doing that? And you're very open to criticism or to conflict and don't take it personally. And I think that you're right. That has to do with an ego that's under control and a mind that's open to learning. And a lot of it has to do with goodwill, that you want to see it work. A lot of people think that relationships are all one way. It's what can you do for me? Marriages, I want to find a wife or I want to find a husband who will make me happy. Well, no one's going to make you happy if you're not happy.
It's such a funny idea that somebody else can do that for you.
But that's the prevalent thing going on in most romantic relationships. It's Valentine's Day. Most romances are based on, hey, you make me happy.
Right.
Isn't
that
true?
How does the other person make you feel? That's what is the dynamic that affects whether we like a relationship or not.
Yeah, yeah. And then when suddenly, you know, the whole thing for better or worse, sickness and poor, you know, whatever, and, you know, till death do we part, a lot of people aren't prepared for that.
Like a year later, they've got nothing to bring to the table and they call it quits.
Yeah. And so therefore, there's a tremendous amount of lying and hypocrisy that people lay on each other going into relationships, even if it's a business relationship. These are all forms of marriage.
Yes.
As they said in The Godfather, I like to make my partners a lot of money.
Is that what they said in The Godfather?
Somebody said it, and, you know, my partners always make a lot of money. If your partners make a lot of money, you're a good partner.
Yeah.
If you're worried about what's in it for you and you don't think about what's the best for the other person, the other person's point of view, you know, what benefit does the other person get being in league with you? And then you're heading for a disaster.
Well, thank you for saying that about me, because I work hard to make sure I don't let... If you don't allow yourself to be criticized, being criticized in a relationship, that's the equal, I think, to falling down. And, you know, if you want to be a good skier, you want to get good at something, surfing, you've got to fall down a lot. You've got to be willing to take your lumps and rebuild and assess and say, how can I do it better?
Well, that's a good thing, and I'm glad I'm glad you see it that way, and it's certainly very enjoyable working with you, and the listeners are great too. This has been a great experience, and I hope we can keep doing it.
Yes, they don't throw as many stones as they used to, and that's always pleasant have stones thrown.
So happy Valentine's Day to everybody, and I guess I'll be out of here. I can hear in the background my jackhammer is starting again, so I don't want to ruin the sound of the radio station. So,
all right. Have a great Valentine's Day yourself.
Yeah.
Drop a lot of money somewhere good with the wife, and we'll see you next week.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Michael Harrison, thank you, sir. We do that first hour every Friday.